We've been discussing the general issue of il faut très faute, and the fact that up until the beginning of this, up until the middle of the 20th century, the middle of the last century, it was generally assumed by everyone, Rabbanim, laymen, everyone, that the halachot of treifot are accurate and represent the a complete list of injuries or defects which were fatal. The Gemara says so explicitly in a couple of places, and the Rambam, the way everybody until the middle of the 20th century interpreted him, was saying the same thing, that you can't add or subtract from the list of treifot, even though he violated his own rules, as he usually does. The Rambam is wonderful in being inconsistent in things like this. The one exception that we find is on the issue of the hole in the head, which was a standard operation on humans, and which some people survived. And
we discussed it in this year many years.
Right, and the Trepan suggests that maybe on this issue, Nishtanu Hatabayim, that nature has changed. And I should say that I've been reading this book on the history of medicine in the 18th century, and again, people there couldn't conceive of the fact that Galen could be mistaken, and also suggested that maybe nature has changed since Galen's time. And of course he draws a logical conclusion from that, which is that in that particular treifa, you cannot rely, in the case of a safek treifa, on the fact that the animal survived for 12 months, because if this no longer represents a fatal defect today, but only reflects a fatal defect as it existed 1,500 years ago, then what proof is it that the animal actually survived?
Can I ask? If nishtanu hatvayim, does that mean it's still a treifa, or does that...
Well, according to the Torah, sure, yes, it's still a treifa.
It's still a treifa.
The laws will not change, but there is a consequence.
The animal survived.
L'chumra, namely, that you cannot rely on the fact that an animal survived to prove that it wasn't a treifa. So that was his opinion. There was always this debate as to whether the actual details of the laws, namely every single little piece of pathology that enters into the laws of the treifa, the things that the poor rabbinical students had to learn prior to receiving smicha up until I don't know when they, if or when they stopped this, but this was certainly part of the standard procedure, whether all of those details were part of what God told Moshe b'Sinai. And many people say no. For example, Rav Yonasan Eifshitz in the Kresu place, he says no, what was given was the eight general rules, that is the eight categories of treifa, but the actual details were worked out by Chazal. But others say no, that all the details were given. And in the famous and funny case of the chicken with the missing heart, Rav Yonasan Eifshitz berates the Chacham Tzvi for declaring that even if many witnesses come and testify to the effect that they, when they opened this chicken it did not have a heart, we wouldn't believe them because they're contradicting the obvious. No animal can live without a heart. And then he berates him for this and says, look, you can't believe anything the doctors say because they say one thing today and the opposite thing tomorrow, and they've thrown Aristotle and out of the window, and therefore the only thing that you can rely on is tradition. The one thing that I can say in defense of him was that in the 18th century, in fact, medicine was in a terribly confusing state. And I just got this book, Plague Legends, which is a very new book, which describes to some extent the confusions of the 18th century, 17th, 18th, and 19th century of medicine, then it really was in a confused state. I can't really recommend the book. It isn't a terribly written book, it's a well-written book, but it has some amount of useful information. Okay. Then comes the 20th century, and especially the period after the First World War, and then with the Second World War after the discovery of antibiotics, when it becomes obvious that these defects are not fatal at all, certainly not in humans, because everybody knows someone who's had an amputation above a certain above the knee, for example, and survives, or everybody knows someone who's undergone appendicitis, or knows of someone who's undergone appendicitis and survives, or aggressive ostomy and survives, or even a surgery on the brain where the meninges are cut through and survives, and so on. So therefore, the fact of the matter is that these things are no longer fatal today. And the two great authorities of the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s both came to similar, not exactly the same, conclusions for opposite reasons, for completely opposite reasons. The Chazon Ish simply declares that he has no belief in experimental science. Experimental evidence is the weakest form of evidence, he says, and then he sort of basically repeats the statement of Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, which may have had some validity in the 18th century, but certainly didn't have that kind of validity when applied to such major discoveries as the circulation of the blood or the germ theory of disease or things of this nature, which lie at the base of modern medicine. And decides that indeed he accepts the position of Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz that the principles of Hilchot Reifot were given to Moses and Sinai, but the actual details were created by Chazal. And in fact, this is part of his general philosophy. His general philosophy is remarkably similar to the philosophy of Zacharia Frankel of the last century, namely that the detailed halachot that we find and are called Hilchot Reifot were themselves crystallized and formulated by Chazal, but he draws the opposite conclusion from what the conservative movement draws from that, because he also says that this power to crystallize the halacha suddenly came to an end with Rabino and Ravash. And therefore, even though certain medications are efficacious today, but were not efficacious 1500 or 1800 years ago, that's simply because some medications are revealed and others become hidden, and we can only make decisions on the basis of which medications were available at the time of Chazal. Of course, he doesn't at all suggest the idea that there was an increase in knowledge, or that the Chazal or the rabbis of the Talmud could have come to some decision based on erroneous medical theories. This is something that's inconceivable to him, and but that's his conclusion. I'm talking about the Chazon Ish. The second great rabbinical scholar of the previous generation who came to a somewhat similar, although slightly different, formulated position was Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he came to this position because he was well aware of the advances in medical knowledge, and he was faced with a problem in which he had to, the details of the case were that a couple was infertile and the doctors wanted to perform a biopsy of the testicle of the husband in order to be able to decide on what the appropriate treatment was to relieve the sterility. And according to an explicit statement in the Gemara, a puncture of the testes prevents the husband from resuming conjugal relations with his wife. So here he had to make a decision explicitly against the Talmudic statement. And here he was willing to say that times have changed. Again, he didn't quite say that the basis of Chazal was wrong, but it's clear that that's what he meant, although he didn't use that language. He said the times have changed, and nowadays this procedure is not fatal, and we don't follow the strict rule. And then he said, but there's a difference between Hilchot Reifot. Hilchot Reifot, even though they are no longer fatal, we follow in detail, and he gave rather weak arguments for that. The key point in one of his arguments was that after all, if this is merely a matter of whether the animal does or does not have fatal defects, then this is something that should be left to specialists. That is, you should call in the veterinarian. If you're going to decide whether a patient is or is not in danger of, does or does not have a fatal disease, you don't rely on the rabbi's assessment of whether or not the disease is fatal or not. You call on the doctor. So therefore, since of course, he's living in the modern age, which is the age of specialists. Since you call in the doctor or whoever the other expert is, this as well you should call in an expert. So why do we need a whole book listing all the trefot, he says. The trefot in detail should not be listed, just the general principle that a fatal defect is what it is, and then if the rabbi has to make a decision, he calls in the veterinarian. Now, this is obviously not a very convincing or a very strong argument, and therefore he says the details of Hilchot Trefot were given to Moses at Sinai and reflected those items which were fatal at that time, and
that's frozen.
And that's frozen for all time. I should add that, you know, this problem itself has disappeared. As I'm sure that the vast majority of Orthodox Jews and of Orthodox rabbis today still believe that Hilchot Trefot represent fatal defects in the animal. They assume, rightly or wrongly, that things have been brought up to date or don't have to be brought up to date because basically the Talmudic assumptions are correct. And the laws of Trefot have indeed passed on to specialists, but not of the kind that Rav Moshe has decided. They have the slaughterhouse, all animal slaughter is now essentially in large packing houses where there are people who do nothing else but spend their lives deciding whether the animal is trefot or not. And they are certainly not, I mean, just think of who would want to go into that particular profession. It will not necessarily attract the most independent intellectually ambitious, let me say, put it that way, person to get involved in that subject. And therefore the problem just simply is not an issue. It's not an issue for anybody. No one is really concerned about this.
Surely the laws is applied as if there's any question at all about the animal.
Except in something which is a glatt kosher place where there's a financial loss attached to declaring the animal trade.
And in Israel, I think there's even a category of basar shelo nishlal b'chol chol.
Whatever. Okay. So I now want to continue because, as you can tell, I'm very sympathetic to Rav Moshe, who was a person that I knew and I have had an enormous respect for, and a little bit critical of the Chazon Ish. So I want to study another tshuva of Rav Moshe, which is again an excellent tshuva, which basically deals with the same issue. It's on page 72. But before I do that, maybe I should go over one additional. This is something that Jonathan knows, but the rest of you don't, maybe unless I discussed it in an earlier shiur. And that is another instance in which the Chazon Ish simply applies Galenic medicine in 1948 to decide a serious halachic question. So this is a series of letters which were published in Hapardes, and I don't remember the exact date of publication, in the early 50s, I guess. I suppose they were sent to the Pardes by the gynecologist who had this interchange of letters with the Chazon Ish, someone by the name of Dr. Taub, who was living in Rehovot, and these letters took place in 1948, if I can get the dates correctly. The problem here is a problem in Hilchot Nida, which is again something that rabbis had to learn in detail, I think, when they would get smicha. Remind me of that. I see. Well, I had to study Hilchot Nida, so I don't know if this is part of the year there that you had to study. Problem that you find in the tshuva literature, I mean a problem which the local rabbi frequently is not expert at answering and therefore requires an expert opinion, is one in which there is some unusual form of bleeding. An unusual form of bleeding, does that count as menstrual bleeding, in which case the woman is a nida, or does that not count as menstrual bleeding? The Gemara itself distinguishes between dam makah, that is, bleeding which is a result of a wound, and dam nida, and bleeding which is a result of the normal menstrual process. and you stack this high of tshuvot where the rabbis have to then decide, is this particular instance dam nida, or is this particular instance dam maka? I mean, if the I don't want to go into the details of all of these questions, but this is a highly pressing problem, and it's so let's just see how the Chazon Ish actually dealt with this problem. So here is Yeshua. It's around. There is some particular procedure, blowing up the fallopian tubes for some reason or other, which occasionally would cause a scratch in the uterus and or in the fallopian tubes themselves, and which would cause some bleeding. And this was the problem. Obviously, this problem didn't come directly to the Chazon Ish. It came to some local rabbi who probably presented it to his rabbi, who finally wanted to get a definitive ruling on this question and turn to the Chazon Ish. So there are four letters, and I want to concentrate on the third. So this is on the top of the left-hand column. Hayakar Marofei Tav Shiyachim. So this is the letter from the Chazon Ish to Dr. Tav. Mechtavam Hayakar Higiyan. You. He received the response, and he needed some more detailed information as to this response. So he adds, "Rutzani l'tzayin ki ha'alacha kovar shlosha inyanei damim." There are three different types of blood. The first type, motar hadam, the excess blood, hanigar min haguf lachutz, ke'ein dam hapsod, the excess blood which is shed by the body outward, like the how would you translate that? Waste blood, or more stronger, poisonous or waste blood. Hamufrach lahasiro min haguf, which the body has to expel. Shelo yaril et dam hachayim, in order not to poison the life blood. Vezu ikar hares. In other words, dam nida, according to the Chazon Ish, is the woman each month accumulates a certain amount of poisonous excess blood, which is stored up and then shed each month. This is straight Galen. So when the Chazon Ish says halacha kovat, he should really have said Galen koveya. On the one hand, this is certainly part of the halachic tradition. If you take a look at the Rambam in his Perush HaMishnah Masechet Midah, he says Mashal Mashlu. The Mishnah says Mashal Mashlu Achachamim Biisha Acheder Avozdar Ba'Aliyadam Acheder Tamei. The Rambam writes, Avozdar is Savar Harechem Ba'Aliyah. Hen shnei ha-tosafot ha-domot l'karnayim she'el ashem al-a'oref ha-rechem u'lefneihem shnei ha-beitzim. That is, they refer to the fallopian tubes and the ovaries that are above them. Tzurah zu nitba'ara b'sifrei ha-nituach. And this anatomy of this is described in the anatomy books. U'bitchabrim b'karka'at ha-rechem. And they combine at the base of the womb, at the base of the uterus. Ruha nikra cheder, which is called a cheder. Or kim bahem, the arteries that feed them. Or kim bahem zareim dam hanida v'nishpach barechem v'yotzei latzavar rechem hanikva postor. In other words, all blood that comes from the uterine artery is dam nida, and therefore, and that's called dam nida. And furthermore, in those, in the fallopian tubes and the ovaries, v'hein hanikra ne'eliyah, orkim acherim, other arteries, and that's of course in modern anatomy, the ovarian artery, v'hein, orkim acherim, v'hein hazanim otah, kisha'ar okei haguf, v'einam ma'avar lahafrasha. In other words, the blood that comes from the ovarian artery is normal blood,
which feeds the uterus and the other organs, and therefore bleeding that comes from there is normal blood, whereas the blood that comes from the uterine artery is the excess blood, which has to be disposed of once a month in the woman. So the Rambam, of course, is again giving you straight Galenic doctrine, as an actual point that goes all the way back to Hippocrates, of, as to the nature of menstruation and menstrual blood. The poisonous blood is in the uterine arteries, and the normal everyday blood is in the ovarian arteries. So therefore you have a very clear-cut distinction between what is dan makkah and what is dan nida. Any injury which causes the ovarian arteries and their tributaries to bleed is dan makkah, and any blood that comes from the uterine arteries is dan nida. Okay. Well, you can't blame the Gemara and you can't blame the Rambam for not knowing about the circulation of the blood. But to decide a halachic issue in 1948, more than 300 years after the discovery of the circulation of the blood, and therefore the complete rejection of this kind of notion that there are two types of blood, and that menstrual bleeding is excess blood, is just a complete... to my mind, abdication of responsibility. But he didn't know. I mean, it's just clear that he didn't know. It's a serious problem, this particular one. As Jonathan can testify, I've been wrestling with this problem for at least the last 7 or 8 months, because some of the leading rabbis who actually decide this issue have been consulting with me, and they are intellectually incapable of believing that the Chazon Ish did not know basic anatomical facts as it existed in 1948. And this makes these problems...
Yeah, but there it is.
It doesn't matter, there it is, but you've seen some of the correspondence that I've had, and it's just heartbreaking, because the people that are on the line to decide these questions have to decide really serious questions, and modern physiology and anatomy throws all of these things into a loop. And for me simply to say that there's no such distinction between dam makkah and dam nidah would overturn 1,000 years of piskei halacha to the harm of the poor woman who comes to with this question.
I don't think
he consulted with a gynecologist.
Yes, I mean, but he never asked about the physiology of menstruation.
I have pity on the poor guy. This was a religious gynecologist living in Rehovot. He probably didn't understand.
He had a passing circuit.
I'm sure that he knew about it and didn't understand what he was asked. He was so bedazzled by the fact that the greatest living scholar who was consulting him about a medical problem was that he just answered the questions that he was asked. I mean, the proof is that I assume that it was he who sent these letters on to this journal, because he was so... And the editors of the journal were quite proud of the fact that, look at what a great modern man the Chazon Ish is. He consults with a gynecologist. And the gynecologist was proud of the fact that he was consulted by the leading scholar. I mean, it's just a weird situation of the psyche.
Yeah.
Yes.
The doctor just didn't have it in it.
But I'm saying...
No, I would suggest something else. It's not...
Because he believed in Galenic doctrine.
Okay. So
the Chazon Ish
believed. So this poor doctor, you can say the same thing. He saw, but he believed in something else.
I don't believe that. I think he just didn't understand what was meant, what the Chazon Ish was writing to him. After all, as Dr. Schwab said, he had to pass a medical exam. He was dealing with real women all the time.
About 1940, they knew basic anatomy.
And then certainly in 1948 they knew basic anatomy. They, to this day, they don't know the detailed physiology of menstruation. I mean, there's still major differences of opinion as to what the actual process is, but they certainly knew that the Galenic theory was wrong. Yeah, right. But they certainly knew that, and they knew that the circulation of the blood was there. So the...
Can I ask, while you're on that? But there was air in these arteries, so what's the point?
What do you mean? Galen, no. Galen believed that there was blood in the organs as well as the air. Right? There was Aristostratus who made the position that the arteries are full only of air. It was one of Galen's great discoveries that the arteries, in fact, contain some blood. So, as I said, from the point of view of practical halacha, this puts me in a very difficult bind, because I have great respect for the people that I'm actually dealing with, and they're the people that get the complicated problems that the local rabbi doesn't deal with and refers to them, and I've known some of their decisions in the past where they've made heroic efforts to help families in many ways. Aviva can attest to that as well. So but still, the people that I'm in contact with cannot psychologically accept the black on white of what it says here, and then have to sort of twist that the Chazon Ish really knew what was going on, but he was saying something else. And the problem itself I've not resolved in my mind. I'm giving it a half year's break so that I can come back to it and think about it a little bit more fresh.
Even on the side, this is such a fundamental issue you've talked about a number of times. If you compartmentalize, you basically say that what's in the Sfarim, what's the next down game, the next four letters, and that has a certain status. And things you might find in journals, or you might get from the colleagues from football or the university, that has a different status. I mean, unless you're willing to sort of say that some of the truth that you know, doesn't go by where it's coming from, but does by some investigation.
Oh,
you're going
to have terrible problems.
I mean, the epicycles and epicycles you're going to need.
Sure, that's a terrible problem, and you know, this particular issue is one in which modern knowledge makes life a lot more complicated. I mean, if there's a two-volume work by Rav Avadya Yosef, which I have upstairs, and if I understand him correctly, again, he allows, for example, I may, my colleagues say that I'm misreading him, and I do not want to go ask Rav Avadya Yosef on this, but I believe, for instance, that he allows bleeding that comes from an IUD, he doesn't construe as menstrual blood.
Even though it does come from the uterus.
Even though it does come from the uterus, because according to the Ramban, Shehim Suleket Damim, there's just, the blood has not yet accumulated, the excess blood. In other words, if I'm saying that here's a situation where relying on the ancient theory gives a lot, it makes a lot of these kulot easier, and if you want to have a bit of compassion for the women involved, you, for which, you know, the whole concept of Hilchot Nida may be somewhat strange or hard, one has to be able to distinguish, to give a rather modern, precise, but not overwhelmingly machmir definition of what is Dam Maka and Dam Nida. And I've not been able to do that. It's not a perilous game. I mean, what am I supposed to do?
No, I'm not saying there's anything practically any different than anything intellectually.
Intellectually, I take the knowledge that I have and use it. I don't try to lie. I don't try to pretend that I'm going to decide an issue according to Galenic medicine when I know it's not correct.
Yeah, but if it weren't for consideration of the practical consequences, which obviously was the synthetic, we want a certain outcome, we want people to be able to, do the things in their lives they want to do without being restricted by halakhah. But intellectually, it's hard to sort of, simply explain what the theory is that you're going by, because it's tortured. I mean, there are ancient distinctions that you're modern understanding.
Not necessarily. I mean, in this particular case, I don't want to spend much time on this because I haven't made up my own mind on some of the key issues here. But, you know, certainly there is a distinction between a bleeding due to a wound and menstrual bleeding. The question is where you draw the line. It's this, and that's the problem. And I can't draw it the way the Chazon Ish drew it, because I don't believe in the theory of excess blood.
We had a similar case a few years ago with the paternity test.
No, it was Rabbi the Tzitz Eliezer, the head of the Rabbi of Shari Tzedek Hospitals.
Sorry, who said that the white stuff comes from him.
Right.
But you can see why he might do that, why he wanted to get rid of paternity tests, because it
Well, Ellen made the same suggestion, but okay. All right. Now I want to read a Tshuva of Rav Moshe, which is, has many wonderful things, many things that we will find objectionable, and also a long insert about why defending his position defending his position, which says that Hilchot Tefot don't reflect modern reality. Okay. So this now was written in 1982 to a couple of doctors, Dr. Ringel and Dr. Yakovowitz. I don't know who they are. Okay, so people didn't bring the. Do we have any more of this?
There's one or two.
My page 72. So he's gotten a whole list of medical ethics issues, questions from doctors. And now Rav Moshe Feinstein. One. Im yesh chorin she'ein liten lahem tufot l'harachat chayehem. Are there certain patients, sick people, who should not be given medication which prolongs their lives? Hine, b'davar im yesh anashim chorin ka'elu. Are there certain types of sick people that one should not give them medication to prolong their lives a little longer? In the story of the death agonies, death of Rebbe, the Bo'o Rabbanan Rachami, Bo'o Ila Tfilatam Shalo Yamut, that the rabbis prayed on his behalf, and their prayer at least succeeded so far that he didn't die, but they did not cure him of his illness. And when his maidservant saw that he was in great pain, let the upper forces shut down the lower ones, that the rabbis below should not be heard. But the rabbis did not stop from praying for his survival. Shakla kuza, she took a pitcher. Shadjei me igra la'ara, she threw it from the roof down onto the ground, so it shattered and made a certain noise. Ishtik murachme, they stopped momentarily from praying. Benach nafshei de Rebbe. And Rebbe died. And the Gemara told us the story to tell us that there are certain times when a person is in great suffering and no medicines are able to cure him, and the prayers for his cure have not been accepted, that there are times when you should pray for the person's death. Because Rebbe's maidservant was wise in the laws of the Torah. And sometimes the rabbis themselves learned halachot from what she said. And explaining that passage in the Gemara, the Hachikama. Pa'amim shetzarich levakesh rachamim al chole sheyamut. Sometimes one has to pray for the death of a patient. Kigon shemitzta'er hachole b'chol yom harvei v'i eshar lo sheyichye. That the man has a fatal illness and he cannot survive, and therefore you should pray for his death. Kiviyamin repertan on say the kevan the chazay am teid the rebbe that am etzpeir am hayu ratzon sheyakofu elyonim et atachtonim kolmar the liyamut rebbe umishum hakika am adam avaker at chole, that if someone visits the sick goreim lo sheyichye, hainu shem, he causes him to survive, Hainu shemo'il b'tfilato afilo lechiyot shezeh b'rov acholim, that in most cases the person who visits the sick person and then prays on his behalf has the effect of having him be cured. V'zeh shetzarech ha'mavarek l'parel b'ruva d'ruva pa'amim, ומי שאינו מבקר אין צריך לומר שאין מולו לחיות, אפילו היכר דאיקולי הנאה במיטה, even in the case where the patient is better off being dead than alive, אפילו אותה זוטרתי אינו מהמם. Even that small amount of benefit that a person refrains from visiting the sick, he doesn't give to the patient. הרי דהרן מדי לדינה חודי פעללי עמתי דרבי, לבסוף כשרץ הרי דרבי תרובה ותפילות רבנון לא מתקבלות לאופו לגמרי, ואף לא להקל יסורות, אלא שיחיה כמו שירו ביסורות, ומחרש גם בדרב דיני שלפעמים צריך המבקר להתפלל שימות כשרואים שיש לו חולה שיחיה ויש לו יסורות. ובאין שיקהה גם, and therefore, for people of this type, שהרופאים מכירים שאי אפשר להתרפות ולחיות, where recovery is impossible, va'af lo sheyifyeh kemo shehu choleh v'lo yisurim, and furthermore he cannot survive without severe pain, aval efshar liton lesameh refuah la'arich yamav kemo shehu, but one can give him certain medical treatment which will prolong his life as it is, sheyinimtza ata b'yisurim, ein liten lo minei refuah, one should therefore not intervene medically to keep him alive longer in agony, Ela Yanichum Kemoshehem. Kilitein lahem sanei refuah shiyamut al yidei zeh, to give a poison so that he should die, v'chein la'asot eizeh pula shiyigrom tzech lekatzer afilu l'rega achat, hu b'chashivut shofech damim. To shorten, actively shorten the life is murder, Ela sheyiyu b'shei ba'al taseh, but the doctors should refrain. Aval l'ikah samim arpe shiyakilu ha'yisurim, but if there are forms of painkillers which will alleviate the pain, the loyu katsu achrega michayach tzarich lasol kishadayin eino goses. Okay. From Rav Moshe Feinstein, sure. You don't like what he did?
Oh, yes, I have. Oh,
V'cholem asukan, however, a person who is seriously ill, she'eino yachol l'nshom, who can't breathe, tzarich liten lo chamtzan, one should give him oxygen, af shehu ba'ofen she'i yashar lifrach oto, she'harei hu lahakel miyisura, because in that case, you're alleviating his suffering, that yisurim imashi yashar l'nshom, the suffering that is caused by not being able to breathe, hem yisurim gedolim, v'chamtzan masalka, and they're relieved by giving him oxygen. על כיוון שלא יהיה ניכר עם ימות שצריך להניחו בצמתן כמיה כמיה שיהיה כל פעם השעה אחת או שתיים וכשיקלה החמצן יהיו אם הוא חי ומדיים יתנו לו עוד חמצן לשעה שתיים. You may want to break this from time to time to see if the patient really is still alive. וכן כל הזמן על הצעה. Now, next. Base. There's another problem. שני חולים. Two people come to the emergency room. She'echad tzorich li'pui b'vadai. One person needs definite treatment. But he certainly will not be able to survive. He'll only be able to keep him alive for a short period of time. V'asheni safekim tzorich li'pui zeh. Another patient in which the need for treatment is not so clear. Aval yicholim l'rachoto eizo mehem kodem. So this is a problem. But then he doesn't say what it is. Remember, this was before the time that serious kinds of transplants were available. This was at the time when a heart transplant was really murder because it was rejected. Okay, so that's the question. It's formulated as a question of triage. In other words, who gets to be treated first? The patient for whom you can treat. Definitely requires treatment, but you know that the treatment would only momentarily or temporarily prolong his life. And a second patient who may not be that serious, it's not clear as much that he needs the same degree of treatment, and therefore you might be able to wait on him, but nevertheless, if you do treat him, the chances are that he will survive. So he gives an interesting answer. שלפי אומדנד הרופאים הוא רק ריפוי לחיי שעה להאריך ימות מה שאפשר להם, ולפעמים הוא רק לסלק ממנו היסורים, אבל צריך לטיפול נמרץ. In other words, the person needs emergency treatment that will only either relieve pain or allow him to survive for a short period of time. והשני לפי עומדה לשם, יכולים לרפותו, אבל אין ידוע להם אם יצטרך לטיפול נמרץ כשזה שעושים בבית החולים ביחידה לטיפול נמרץ, emergency room. In other words, the question is, who gets into the emergency room? ויש שם רק מיטה אחת ביחידה. There's only one bed available in the emergency room. מי קודם להכניס לשם לטיפול הנמרץ? בתחילה כשבאו בבת אחת. They both appeared simultaneously before the emergency room. Whom do you treat first? ובדיעבד, כשבא רק אחד והכניסו, ועדיין לא התחילו לטפל בו, ובא השני, and secondly, what happens if one got into the emergency room and then the other came, you take the first one out. And she said, הנה נראה לעניית דעתי, שאם באו שניהם בבת אחת, היינו קודם שהכניסו האחד מהם, before either one was taken into the emergency room, צריך להכניס בתחילה את בני של הדעת, הרופאים הנמצאים שם יכולים לרפותו. אם גם לחולה זה צריך להתחיל תקן, אם יש צורך, אף מספק. In other words, priority is given to the person that will be able to survive, not to the person for whom you'll be able to prolong his life for a short amount of time. ואם כבר הכניסו שם את החולה שלדעתם הוא רק לחיי שעה, אין מוציאים אותו משם. בין שהכניסו כדין מחמת שעדיין לא היה שם החולה השני, בין שעשו שלא כדין, בין שרגינו מזידין, אין מוציאים אותו משם, והטעם פשוט. And he said, the reason for this decision is simple. בוודאי חיי הראוי להתרפא ולחיות כל ימי חייו הראויים שיהיה כדרך סתם אנשי, a person who can be restored to a normal life, עדיף על מאלו שעומדים למות מצד החולי שלהם, שלא ידוע לרופאים ופועל למחלתה. אבל זהו לעל. In other words, as far as we, a third party, is concerned, we should prefer to give treatment to the person who can be restored to a full life. מאלו שעומדים למות מצד השם שהגיעו לרופאים לפני שנולדת. אבל זהו לעלמא. That's talking about the responsibilities that we have as a third party, as the physician, as the head of the hospital, for making a choice. אבל החולה עצמו לקח חיוב להציל נפש אחרים בנפשו. But the person, the sick person who will only live for a short time, is not obliged to sacrifice his own life, even for a moment, in order to save somebody else's life. And therefore he decides that if the person who cannot be restored to a full life but only kept alive for a few hours or a few days is already been brought into the emergency room, he has already acquired the rights to be treated, and therefore he is not obligated to give up those rights, and we can't make that demand on him to give up the few remaining hours he has of his life in order to save somebody else's life.
It's interesting, he's trusting the doctors about these very much more significant issues when it comes to
health. No, he is trusting the veterinarian, he's just simply saying to the veterinarian, he's saying he's irrelevant. So I think that this is a very plausible decision that he comes to. He comes to it without citing any kind of halachic or Talmudic sources. He's just offering a certain amount of common sense that the community as a whole, if it's making a decision, should decide in favor of, say, restoring a person to a full life. But that obligation doesn't fall on the patient, whose life would be shortened thereby. So therefore, if he has already been put in a position in which he's expecting treatment, that is, he's been brought into the emergency room, you can't take him out of the emergency room in order to save somebody else's life, because that's his decision. Okay. Well, usually in these kinds of cases, he's not in a mental state to make a decision. On the issue of whether a person is allowed to sacrifice his temporary life in order to save someone else's life, there's a famous tshuva of Rav Kook that we studied this many times many years ago, and if you like, on some future occasion we can go through that. Rav Kook decides that the person himself does have the right to make that decision, but similar, we cannot force him to make such a decision.
But again, because the person is presumably not conscious, the issue of the despair that the person that may then shorten the person's life is not a factor here.
No, but it's not clear that he's unconscious, but in any event, we cannot.
It was not a fact.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, I think that you just, yes, you discussed that in the next time. Okay, so now, on the third issue here,